All right, first thing, please tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a summary of what you were doing there.
My name is Madhav Mohan, and I was an international civil party lawyer for Case 2 Mini Trial 1 before the Extraordinary Chambers of the Courts of Cambodia. I have been in Cambodia or had an association with Cambodia since 2005 through several international NGOs. And in about 2007, my wife and I co-founded Access to Justice Asia LLP as a vehicle almost to actually do legal representation of a minority indigenous group in Cambodia before the court.
Awesome. So this was the first time that civil party representation was actually included in an international tribunal. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what worked well in that process and if such a system was going to be used again, maybe some improvements that could be made?
Sure. You're right to say, I think this was the first time it was used in 2006-2007 in an internationalized tribunal. There was a call earlier in the ICTY and the ICTR by, I think, Carla Del Ponte, who was the prosecutor, chief prosecutor for both tribunals, to actually introduce an element of victims participating in the process. But there was a lot of backlash against involving victims, primarily from judges and lawyers, if you'd imagine that. And I think the ECCC sort of really sort of trailblazed in this regard. It has been regarded by several academics and international experts as being a high watermark for victim participation in that process before the ECCC, and has inspired actually similar processes before the ICC. So I'm just looking at my notes very quickly, and I noticed that the ICC allows us to initiate proceedings on a request for reparations against a convicted person. The victim is allowed to share experiences and other relevant information. So that's kind of like the parameters of involvement of the ICC by victim participants under the Rome Statute. At the ECCC, I think the contrast was always the idea of the French system. And the French system allowed an immediate involvement as partie civile. So there actually will be active participants in the process or parties in the process. And the big difference or the big introduction that was coming here is the ability to not only have legal representatives represent you in court, but to actually be involved from the investigative stage all the way through the end, through the appeal. And I think that was a very, very valuable process for the civil parties. So that is the pros, I would say, in the process. If I could talk about, even at the early stage, cons that did come up. One point that did come up, and this was a very early point that I would say, sort of like, because at Arja we saw, even though we were not involved in case one, when Doik was before the tribunal, we saw the process through from that perspective. And we noticed already that a lot of things were lost in translation. So as you would know, there are limits in terms of the reparations that can be requested by a civil party, moral and collective reparations. And the idea would be that a person would not be actually seeking financial compensation as reparations. But the word reparations in Khmer, as it was translated by the court translators, included the idea of compensation financially. And so this created, from the early days, confusion as to what the victims or civil parties would expect. So in terms of the streams, in terms of the people who would be testifying or giving evidence, you would have, of course, witnesses before the court. You would also have civil parties and complainants. So when you have these two to three categories of people who could actually testify and give evidence before the court, there wasn't much of a clear understanding as to why someone would want to be a civil party. And so a lot of civil parties that were coming to the various legal organizations and lawyers were immediately asking, can I have this particular financial reparation? This is why I choose to be a civil party. And so I think that confusion took a long time to sort out. And so I think that was something that hadn't been provided for right from the outset. So I think if outreach had solved that situation from the court's perspective, right from the beginning, it would have made all the public forums that happened after that much easier and much more straightforward.
Gotcha. That certainly makes sense. So Maybe thinking a bit about that, can you tell us maybe some of the other challenges that you faced in your work with ACCC?
I think there are two significant challenges that we faced. And I would say I would go beyond the typical challenges that would come to mind with the ACCC. Like everybody knows, it took 13 years. It's been taking 13 years from the beginning. It's, what are we looking at? $300 million poorer for it. And the questions about could that money have been spent better on hospitals and schools? But moving beyond the institutional questions, the liminal institutional questions, I think in the process itself, there were significant stumbling blocks for civil parties, which stood out. And if I could complain about them, let me do so. First complaint that I would have is the severance orders. So now focusing, like moving away from case one or the beginning of the process, when you went into the case two mini trial one, severance became a real challenge for the lawyers and for the civil parties when we were dealing with it. Let me give you a very specific example. So for case two mini trial one, forced evacuations was within the scope of the indictment. But in the process of even giving evidence, you'd imagine civil parties would be stopped by legitimate objections from the defense, because the objection would be, well, this is actually not within this particular scope of mini trial one. So you'd actually have people to say, well, even though it's part of the forced evacuation, it's not quite within the temporal ambit of this particular indictment. You should wait for mini trial two to raise the exact same question around the exact same facts. And this gave a real difficulty and a challenge for civil parties, because you would imagine in court, even in commercial cases, you want to be able to have your evidence in chief flowing without having to be stumbled and stopped. And we're talking about people speaking in French or English, translated, and then waiting for the Khmer response and then translated back to us. So along the way, I think if every time an objection was raised, and again, these objections by the defense were legitimate objections, because if what the parameters had been set by the court was, it's only evidence that's within this very, very, very narrow remit because of the severance order, all the defense would have to raise to say, well, we can't actually talk about this. Because even though we don't mean to be rude or difficult with the witness, but we are stopping the witness because he's extending or she's extending beyond the scope of the trial. So what happened then is we would actually see a lot of frustrations that the civil parties were facing. They would say, like, you know, I'm being stopped in the middle of my statement. So that was a huge challenge that happened. So I would say the severance orders were sort of almost on a practical daily basis, a way to, one, prolong the process, two, repeat evidence, which would allow also defense and prosecution. So as you'd know, even though we're supposed to be supporting the prosecution, if for some reason the prosecution were to feel that we were not actually giving evidence or our clients were not giving evidence in support of their charge, they would be happy to decouple from our case theory, right? And in doing so, we would actually find a lot of very technical questions being raised around evidence, which could have been much more easily handled if it was one trial, right? And even if it was two mini trials within that one trial, if there was some way of saying, look, all the evidence that has already been pled in case 2/1 could be replicated and copied and pasted into case 2/2, it would have had a much better, I think, final effect. So to give one example, I mean, sort of, again, just to complete the forced evacuation example, imagine if you're going through someone who was evacuated from Phnom Penh to Kuristan from 76 into 77 into 78. So the idea is that 76 would be out of jurisdiction, temporally speaking. Fair enough. But what happens if at the 77, you start into terms of where the person was evacuated from? And of course, if you're starting with where they evacuated from, you've got to go to where they ultimately resulted to be moved to. So that move to extends not because of a temporal restriction, because of more a kind of spatial restriction, a geographical restriction. To say, let's say it went into a particular province or prison site that was not one of the prison sites that was named in the indictment. So immediately you'd be stopped from giving that evidence. So I think that became like, there's a lot of artificiality, I would say, from a civil party's perspective, in terms of how they would give evidence to make ultimately a charge to say that they were taken forcibly from one place to another. And told again, and this is where it becomes difficult to say, and this is where I think for us, we felt it very, very clearly. The Khmer Krum community that we were representing were not directly mentioned in the introductory submissions of the court. So as a result, we would be kind of piggybacking on what was being experienced by the Vietnamese community. Mm-hmm. This was clearer for Case 2 Mini Trial 2 because genocide was seen as a crime within the indictment for both Cham Muslims as well as the Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. But where genocide was not within the scope of it for the first mini trial, it was very difficult for us. That huge challenge for us was like, where do we go into something where we're looking at a targeted systematic violation visited upon this particular community? And how do we explain that without sort of falling foul on the very technical rules that were being applied geographically, spatially, temporally? This maybe if I could segue, if you don't mind, into the opportunity that this provided. So these were the very, very technical challenges that I think lawyers face all the time, even in like domestic cases, in terms of like sticking within the parameters of what the court allows you to adduce evidence for. The difficulty here was because it was a very emotionally charged process where people were talking about their suffering. There was an opportunity that came for many of the civil parties in Case 2 Mini Trial 1. Mini Trial 1. And that was the opportunity to actually use the impact statement right at the end of this, of the testimony. So basically after the evidence has been pled before the court and even after they've been cross-examined. So what happens after evidence in chief and cross-examination is there is either a victim impact statement that's made in writing and or it's complemented with an oral testimony, which is a statement of suffering. I think this was a novel feature of the court process as well. I'd say that the ICC, there's sort of questions and concerns can be mentioned as well. But before the ECCC, it was nice to have like a dedicated segment at the end of all the testimony for a client or a civil party to be able to actually talk about what they went through. Talking about severance, where the evidence in terms of what happened to them during 77 to 79 would be very carefully scrutinized. The statement of suffering could be a more global perspective. So what happened to them during the entire period without sort of like breaking it down into the various crimes that you'd have to very carefully pick and choose. So this gave an opportunity for civil parties and one client that we represented, Mr. Chowney in particular, used this, I think, to very, very good effect in my perspective. So in being able to talk more generally about what they suffered, it was difficult for them to say, well, I'm going to talk about what I suffered, but I'm not going to mention anything about the facts or the circumstances surrounding what caused me to suffer this. So that was a chance for them, I think, half cheekily to be able to say, well, even if I'm going to be stopped 5 times by this defense counsel, and every time that stoppage or that objection is being sustained by the judge, maybe I should just wait for my statements of suffering. It was an interesting situation where questions were actually put by him directly to the accused person, Mr. Q Sampan. And this happened, I think, for the first time through him. So what is basically happening, like I mentioned, the statements of suffering happened at the end of the entire segment. So basically, there's evidence in chief, cross-examination by the defense, re-examination by the prosecution, and it comes back to the victim civil parties. And they can actually say a statement. Usually it's a scripted statement. It's very controlled. It's almost like a speech that they read out. And often they, of course, it's the first time they're appearing before a very formal legal process. And so they're careful about what they're saying. Our client in this particular situation was wanting to raise a question about the location of his deceased uncle or allegedly deceased uncle. And what was unknown to the defense at that time, they expected as often as you'd imagine, The processes in the court process can be very time consuming, long, dreary and boring. And you'd see even judges drifting off from time to time. But in this particular situation, there was a direct question that was asked by the client, by the civil party, to the judge to say, "Your Honor, could I actually ask a question of Mr. Kyusampan?" So the response by Judge Laverne at that time was to say, "Well, given the system, well, you can at least tell me what you want to ask, and I can decide whether or not you can actually ask that particular question in the form that you want to ask it, or whether you're going to put that question through your lawyer or through me as the judge." And the client said, "I just want to ask him what happened to my uncle, Chow Sao." And I asked because Chow Sao was known to Mr. Kyusampan. Mr. Kyusampan used to have lunch in our house. So maybe he will know what happened to him directly.
Wow.
So this caused an immediate reaction. I mean, it was the most fun I've had in court, actually, at the HPC. because physically, you had the defense lawyers stand up, because two interesting things happened. One is people were not sure how the judges were going to react at that point, whether they were going to allow that question to be asked, either directly or indirectly, or whether they're going to like basically say, no, this is not permitted. Second, so they raised an objection immediately. The second thing is, in response to that question as to I want to ask Mr. Kyusampan, Mr. Kyusampan stood up in court. Again, a very rare situation. Both Mr. Nunshia and Mr. Kyusampan prefer not to directly address the court, especially when a witness asks a question. So his lawyers were between standing to raise an objection on one lawyer, and the other lawyer was standing up to actually pull him down back into his seat. And so I would say that these are the sort of, you know, answering your more general question in terms of sort of what stands out in terms of the novel experiences that happened because of the civil party process. The statement of suffering, which almost was a footnote in the entire testimony, became the basis for a very relevant question, which could be potentially incriminatory, being asked. So for the first time, the judges on the spot had to decide as to, you know, what is the modality of asking questions? Can a statement of suffering involve and include questions? Would those questions have to be given to them ahead of time? Could they be asked impromptu? What is the role of the lawyers? Because if this is truly a civil party, civil law system, well, the judge can ask questions. The witness / civil party can answer those questions directly without the intervention of a lawyer. They have, and the defense or the accused person has the right to either answer the question or remain silent. So at this point, I think sort of like rules were set. So it was sort of like almost from a common law perspective, instead of like following like a codified rule in the internal rules of the ACCC, you had judges making pronouncements on that day to determine how this would be done. Ultimately, they agreed that that question could be asked of Mr. Kyusampan, despite the protestations of the defense. And we then, of course, after the legal discussions and when the question was asked, it was interesting because Mr. Kyusampan did stand up to start answering. And immediately, the defense said, "Well, if Mr. Kyusampan is asked a question, we reserve the right to ask questions of our own." So what was the last 5 minutes in a statement of suffering at the end of a testimony by one of the 31 civil parties, given that 4,000 civil parties had been admitted, only 31 were giving evidence in court. Mm-hmm. One of these 31 then set a precedent to say, "Well, you know, actually, you can start asking questions directly, right? And if there's just going to be sort of like a little bit of a procedure to say, tell the court ahead of time, let the court decide. You don't get to just ask a question directly to the person. You're not going to have a dialogue with the accused person, right? But if the judge is going to be your medium, right? And if the lawyers can actually prove the legal case for you to be able to ask this question, you can actually do so." So that began two things. The first is there was an entire procedure in place in terms of how questions or what questions could be put forward in writing and how they could be asked, the modalities of victim participation. It went from telling truth, truth-telling as we'd imagine what, you know, giving testimony is all about, and what we understand retributive processes to include when we have victim civil parties. But it went to a much more restorative process to say that, you know, part of it is also truth-seeking. You have every right to ask for the truth. So it sort of embedded a little bit of a truth-seeking mission, not sort of externally. So it wasn't sort of like an add-on separate process, unlike other tribunals, like ICTR, for example, where you have like a gachacha process. This became the first, in my mind, element of actually sort of embedding through questions, through the statement of suffering or the victim impact statement, an element of victim civil parties asking for the truth. And of course, adverse inferences could be drawn if that truth was not given to the judge's satisfaction.
Yeah, that's a lot of interesting stuff. And thank you for sharing that story with us. It's nice to hear how some of these issues that have been discussed by some of our other interviewees actually affected civil parties directly. So thank you for that. And I'm glad that you brought up the issue of evidence, because one of the defense attorneys we spoke to actually mentioned the same issues, but of course from the other side. So it's great that we had to hear both sides of this from you guys. Okay, so let's turn back to reparations. So you mentioned already that this is an area where there's some confusion initially. Keeping that in mind, expectations that the civil parties may have had, you know, just from their own knowledge, and also keeping in mind how perhaps those expectations may have changed once they got a better idea of what was realistic for the trial. How well do you think the reparations that were actually implemented reflected the civil parties' interests as a whole? Or if you'd like to speak to the Khmer Krom in particular, that works too.
Sure, happy to answer that question from my perspective. The straightforward answer, of course, is to say that anything that happened in terms of reparations for case 2/1 or /2 was leaps and bounds better than what happened for the first case. I think there was a much more specificity that went into the reparation requests for the second case. Again, going in terms of what I would say, the upshot of the reparation requests was it sort of forced the civil party lawyers or compelled the civil party lawyers to actually start working together much more, to actually sit down in committees, of course, sort of shepherded by the lead co-lawyers for civil parties, to say, well, are you going to have reparations in almost buckets? So are you seeking, for example, reparation requests that specifically answers questions by your civil party group to establish, let's say, a memorial? Or are you seeking to have schools or hospitals, whatever you're trying to seek the collective reparations to ultimately benefit, how is that going to work and which groups are you going to be speaking for? So I think that was one benefit compared to the first trial, where people would be kind of told to sit down and think about how to do this. The difficulty was always whether there was going to be symmetry between what the victim support section was doing and what the legal lawyers were doing. And I say this because ultimately I feel for both mini trials, but especially I think the first mini trial, case 2/1, there was a sense of abdication of responsibility. So you'd feel sort of the victim support section saying, well, it's not our mandate. We can't be in charge of raising the monies for this. If the monies are not coming to support a particular reparation request, how can that be on us? It should be up to the INGOs who are involved with a particular victim group to help raise this money. The lead co-lawyers would say, well, our job as the lead co-lawyers is to present their case, to suggest what reparations should be there, to ensure that specificity is there for, let's say, for example, the 13 reparation requests that were put forward. You know, how do we ensure that all of them, you know, meet, pass muster, and get approved by the court. But you would have a situation where you, these different groups would have almost a bureaucratic discussion, which ultimately turned on who was raising monies for the reparation. And this, of course, is a little bit different from obviously what happens with the ICC with the trust fund. But over here, it was not much of a guided process. We didn't really have much involvement from both the national and international sides. The question from both both parties, especially for the international stakeholders, was always, do we have enough money for the court to keep on going on? It wasn't, do we have enough money to actually support this particular reparation? So I think that is a pity that it wasn't managed better from that perspective. And I think it's reparation requests should never be put solely in the hands of lawyers, because we're not used to sort of like spending time. We're used to spending time saying why there's been egregious conduct and that reparations should be paid or should be made, but not so much about asking about how that's going to be manifest at the end of the day. I think the NGOs that did actually pull through, that I'm very happy that as they did, were the ones who already had a pre-existing relationship with the communities. So, I mean, DC CAM is definitely one of them. To actually come forward to say, look, if this reparation request, for example, to have a mobile museum, to have a permanent museum established, so we can record the stories of all the victim groups. So, for instance, we're talking about the Cham Muslims, the Vietnamese, the Khmer Krom together. These minority groups could be put together as the people who were systematically targeted through forced discrimination. I think that was very helpful when you actually had people who were going to be facilitating the process and trying to do the best that they could in the circumstances. What helped a lot also was the coordination that did happen where it did between the prosecution, the INGOs, and the lead lawyers. So when you had the INGOs actually canvassing for the money that's required for the various reparation requests to ultimately be realized, where they would be able to actually sit down to say, well, some parts of these reparation requests that are being put forward by the lawyers or the co-lead lawyers for civil parties are less realistic than others. It's going to be difficult to sustain them in court. And if the prosecution, which didn't have a vested interest in wanting reparations, but was there sort of almost to say like, look, we are out to ensure that this charge sticks and your reparation request follows on from this, they would still be able to say, to give an example. So like where you had for case 2/1 and /2, 11 projects which were fully funded, there seemed to be much more of a rigorous application of how these reparation requests were going to be carried out, because the funders had insisted upon it from the start. They were telling the NGOs, the facilitators, they were telling the victim groups to say, well, if we are going to be giving this money for this particular purpose, tell us how it's going to be used. As a result, it was easier for the civil party lawyers as well as the NGO groups to work together to put that before the court. There were, along the way, other reparation requests which were more vague and about 4 to 5 for both cases ended up being rejected ultimately. So I think our heart, or at least my heart, goes out to the ones which were rejected, because there isn't really a very clear reason as to why some were rejected and others were allowed. And you'll find if you trawl through the transcripts, several mentions of this, you know, because the immediate impression from victims groups, for instance, let's say there was a request by the clients I was representing, the Khmer Krom, to say that, you know, this is what we require, this is what we want. And if that particular reparation request was not granted by the court, their immediate assumption would be to say that they became a forgotten person or a forgotten voice, as opposed to other minority groups which were directly vindicated through reparations. So it became quite a divisive factor, especially for the 4 to 5 reparation requests which were not ultimately sustained. I think the reason they were not sustained, obviously, was not not as much political for the reparation request. I've got a different view in terms of the charges and the ultimate decisions, but the reparation request, I think, was not as politically motivated. But there was this very real, almost fiscal reason for why things were not sustained. It was purely financial. Did you have people who would sit down, plan how this was going to work, and put a very realistic proposal before the court to say, if this was allowed, these are the interests that this is going to vindicate. It will have a larger global resonance. It wouldn't be only for one community. It would actually be benefiting communities as a whole, victims at large.
Thinking about reparations, as you've been talking about it, do you think this civil party participation should be included in future international tribunals? And if so, what changes do you think would be helpful to make this model work for international criminal tribunals in the future?
I certainly think that this particular system of reparations and civil party participation should be included. I think there are several examples, both for the two mini trials, where reparations requests which were asked for were granted and vindicated victims and civil parties' rights. This should be replicated going forward, with a few exceptions, with a few modifications or changes, if I may suggest it. The first change would be, going back to a point I made earlier, is there has to be a coordination between the legal section, for ECCC was the co-lead lawyer section, both the national and the international side, as well as the more administrative or victim support section side of things. So if there is no coordination between the two, we see a lot of problems arising, some of which I mentioned earlier. There has to also be, I think, a clear sort of plan, not just at the end, but throughout the trial stages. The minute sort of evidence is adduced, there should be a continuing kind of obligation on the part of the civil party lawyers, as well as the victim support section, to start thinking about how we can start raising monies to ultimately realize the reparation requests that are going to be made. So rather than waiting for the last 6 months after conviction to do it, I think it has to be something that we start thinking from the middle part of the trial process.
Okay, sounds good to me. So kind of thinking a little bit more broadly then, were there any best practices that you developed or saw regarding civil party participations that you think would be helpful for future courts, or any other recommendations that you would have?
I think the most important point that I would take away from the civil party process or participation in the processes, I think the investigations can't be left purely to the prosecution and the investigating judges. I know that's their mandated legal obligation and duty to do so, but our experience representing the Khmer Krom was to notice that there were huge pockets of data which was never uncovered. So I think it sort of falls on both the civil party lawyers and even on the defense to start doing their own parallel investigations. How that ultimately would be done is another question, but what we saw happened is, in a lot of ways, what ultimately became case 4 or elements of case 4 against accused persons such as Yim Tith were based, in our mind, largely on the supplemental investigations and submissions that we made to the court. Because this actually talked about the Khmer Krom and the Vietnamese populations and specifically looked at genocide as the singular charge beyond crimes against humanity. This was never within the original scope of what the prosecutors were thinking about or what the investigating judges were thinking about. So we had to go out of our way to kind of like speak to these prosecutors and judges and go out on almost joint discovery expeditions. If I can give one example, there was a situation where together with DC Cam, and at that time, Mr. Andrew Cayley QC, who was the chief international prosecutor for the ECCC, we actually had a combined field trip to two provinces. And the data that was collected from these provinces was then something that became the basis of both prosecutorial supplemental charges or investigations, as well as a supplemental investigation request by the civil parties. Separate investigative requests, because the scope of those requests would be separate, but it would be an opportunity, I think, for civil party lawyers to be of best assistance to the civil parties. Because our question is always going to be vindicating the interests of our clients, right? And if our clients' interests are ultimately to look out at the gaps that are there in the introductory submissions, in what's being done by the investigative judges, in what's being done by the investigators and by the prosecutors. Filling those gaps and ensuring that they have a voice, I think, is a very meaningful and useful part of the process.
Great. All right. And since you were working with civil parties directly, I wonder if there are any accused or survivor stories that particularly stand out to you. You mentioned one already, speaking with Kyu Sempong. Was that the one that resonated with you most, or were there others that particularly struck you?
I think that example is certainly one that stays with me, partly also because I think it was the initiative that was taken by the client. There are several more examples, and I would say for every other example that I would give, it would be a situation where the victim civil parties actually would be the one who are leading the charge. So even if they're not leading the charge in court, they are there with us when we go to the provinces. So they sit down with us to talk about, well, this is exactly what happened. I'm going to show you the areas that were demarcated. One very clear sort of image that pops out in my mind is actually sitting down with a group of civil parties in the Khmer Krom community, speaking to them through a translator and starting to talk about, well, exactly where were the specific crime sites. So if you're talking to me about enslavement, as an example, if you're talking to me about imprisonment, forced imprisonment in this particular area, can you show me where that particular prison was? Because I can't see it now. It's been 30 years or 35 years after the fact, right? And I think sort of sitting down and mapping the process was something that really stayed with me and the rest of the group, because we were mapping the process in two ways. We're using Google Maps to figure out where it happened, right? And Google Maps obviously does not name crime sites, but we had Google Maps and we had like a road directory, like how you drive to the place. And then we had to look at the community that currently live there, who are not our clients, but they are the current occupants of that area. And we would start asking questions about, well, do you remember 30 years ago that there was actually something else here? Do you have family members who experienced it? And they would be able to say, even if they didn't have family members, they have these oral narrative stories they carried with them. So there are a lot of rich stories, which I think sort of, again, they don't quite fall under the rubric of what you'd actually put before a court, but they give context because they explain the testimony. They explain why people feel very strongly about ensuring that crimes that happened should not be forgotten. Why, even though people like Kyu Sempong or Noon Shear have life sentences against their names, why does it matter so much to civil parties that case 3 and case 4 happen against other second tier, second level, most responsible people? Because often the question that comes back to us to say, well, you know, yeah, Kyu Sempong, Noon Shear, we feel we obviously have a lot of feelings we want to share about their participation, but they may not have been the ones who were holding the machete. They were not the ones who were actually ordering directly what happened. We want to ensure that those people are behind bars because we know where they live now, and they seem to be doing very well. They're going to live with impunity and without accountability. So that's always going to be something that's going to be two things that happen, right? One is, how do you explain to them that not every single person will be able to be found convicted by this court? But the more difficult question is explaining to them why, even with those 31 who did give evidence, why not everything that they said ultimately comes before the court judgment and results in reparations that they asked for? And that's tough to explain.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be pretty tough, this whole process, I would think. Okay, so looking forward a bit, what do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be for Cambodia, both today and maybe 20 years in the future?
I think that the direct impact now, and if I were to speak very plainly, if you asked me this question 5 years ago, 4 to 5 years ago, I would say, well, we were at a time where case two had been completed. We are well on the way to having evidence before case 2/2, the second mini trial, which completed like in 2018, I think, after the appeals were done. There was the sense that of hope, that everything concluded and there was a clear justification why there was an internationalized process, which didn't happen in The Hague, but which happened at the doorstep, which looked at evidence that was put forward by victims and civil parties in their own voices, in their own language. I think that was very resonant and it still matters in my view. The difficulty I think that's a lot of people are facing today is if case three and case four were always doomed to be in gridlock, shouldn't they just have been folded into case one or case two right from the beginning? And that is it's a very valid question. And I've been asked this several times by civil party clients. Couldn't case two have been one case? And couldn't case three or four, you know, against Miamuth or Imtith just have been including more accused persons? So the legal delicacies are lost on civil parties and victims. And I think that's one huge learning that we have to take away from this. For any future trial process, if it does happen in Southeast Asia, for example, I think that's a big learning they've got to take from this. The second point, I think, positively speaking, that it will hopefully be having impact on rule of law in Cambodia and more generally in Southeast Asia. I say this because a lot, and this is more sort of like from a capacity building perspective, many of the lawyers involved in the process, civil party lawyers, domestic civil party lawyers, national civil party lawyers, both who are lawyers who represented clients together with myself or other victim groups, have gone on to become extremely good lawyers. It was a training ground for law students whom we worked with from RUL and from PUC for Panyasa to actually train them in what advocacy would be like, for them to actually speak in Khmer and English or French before a court process. I think that was a huge impact for the legal system. And I think going forward, you know, like we're just coming on the heels of 8 hours ago, a decision by the International Court of Justice, right? Talking about how you could have, even if it's not going to be the ICC, there are going to be international tribunals which are looking as to what we could do to prevent and punish genocide. So this is an ongoing concern in this part of the world. So if nothing else, at least people are thinking about it. And DC CAM's mandate, for example, to ensure that things are documented and that accountability ultimately will be done, should never be forgotten.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. Do you want to be cognizant of our timing right now? But is there anything else super pressing that you think we should talk about?
I think not specifically from my perspective. The only point if I could say is that as this process winds down, which I think is clearly the writing on the wall, I think there is an opportunity for the leading lights in Cambodia, right? You know, people like Yuk and others to start thinking about what processes that they can take from this particular 13-year ordeal to ensure beyond the process that I mentioned earlier, but about capacity building more generally, and for the rule of law to have like a more stable grounding in Cambodia, but what they can kind of do to share their learnings with other countries. Myanmar is one, Sri Lanka is another. There are tons of countries in this region and beyond that could really learn from Cambodia, including The Hague. So I think that's something that, you know, DC CAM and others should do.
Great. Well, thank you again for speaking with us. We really appreciate your time.